Welcome back to Stand-Up Comedy Secrets for Beginners. I'm Ron Temple, and I'm here again with leading stand-up comedy expert Steve Roy. Hi, Steve.
Hey, man.
Before we start today's show, I have a couple of follow-up questions I would like to ask you. So the first question is it okay to ask you a few questions?
Yeah, of course it is.
All right, so I want to make sure I got that one out. All right, Steve, you appear to put a lot of emphasis on laughter as a measure of a comedian's success, the 4 to 6 laughs per minute. Can you explain this concept again?
Well, I don't know that it's such a concept. It's what professional comedians have been able to do for decades. The ones that hit it, the ones that make any progress, the ones that you see on TV, the ones that you see on the online videos at YouTube. It's just a really simple thing. When it comes to generating that type of laughter, because that's what gets you noticed. That's what gets you noticed by everyone in the business. When you can generate 4 to 6 quality laughs per minute. Now, I'm going to get into later on about how the actual number of laughs is not as important as the number of seconds of laughter that you generate in a minute. But by and large, if you take a look, just like I said before, if you go to YouTube, find your favorite comedian performing stand-up comedy, they're killing, and just start the video and start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And you'll find that some of those folks will actually be generating more than 6 laughs in any 1 minute. But by and large, it's 4 to 6 laughs per minute. Now, when I was producing my course, I wanted to have something that people could grab onto as far as self-evaluation goes. So, you know, I counted the laughter on my recordings of my stand-up comedy routine. And then I went and found dozens, literally dozens of other comedians, you know, from, at the time, cassette tapes and CDs and those types of things. And it's pretty darn consistent. So,
8-track? Did you get 8-track?
No, dude. I'm sorry. I didn't manage to get the 8-track thing. It was a little bit too far gone by that point.
Okay, good. All right. I had a next question was the joke formula. How to write jokes, which seems to be the current wisdom for learning how to perform stand-up. Why then does writing jokes using the joke formula not work?
Well, the problem is trying to use a joke formula is nothing more than an after-the-fact recognition of something that someone else has already done. And you can lump these things that other comedians did, but that doesn't help you in any way produce your own stand-up comedy material. One of the big problems with this whole joke formula thing is that what if what you do and how you talk and how you express yourself doesn't really fall into that? It doesn't fall into a formula that's been recognized.
So it's the formula that they're using is kind of a general kind of view, may or may not work for you, but there is a possibility that somebody might in fact make it work?
On occasion. But here's the thing. I mean, let's go back to the 4 to 6 laughs per minute thing. You need to be able to produce for a 3-minute set that's what, 12? To 18 jokes for just a 3-minute set. I mean, and what are you going to do? Work one at a time and try to do the formula thing? This is one of the big problems with this whole stand-up comedy writing thing is they try to do it like you're putting together a bookshelf. If you'll just follow X rule this, put this peg in here, this and that, then suddenly you're going to rock on stage. And let me tell you what, that kind of thing comes out as phony, first of all, because you're trying to mechanically use a sense of humor that you don't really even know works or not. And audiences aren't stupid. They know when they're being joked. It's no different than you know when someone's not telling you the truth, even though the words, the literal words they're saying are truthful. Is that a good,
Are you asking me if I've been lied to?
No. I guess what I'm asking you is, was there a time in your life when you knew someone was, the words they were saying were truthful, but you knew they weren't telling you the complete picture.
Yeah, I think we're saying the same thing, because remember, 20 years in the Navy, I've been lied to.
Oh, dude.
I've been knowingly lied to.
Well, I did 20 years in the Navy and did two wives before this one. Trust me. I know a little bit about that being lied to thing, whether the words were accurate or not.
Yeah. So what you're saying with the joke formula, it really, the audience will pick up on it. If it's not genuine, they're going to know it's not genuine.
Well, the thing about it is again, and here's another problem with that, is it's an outside-in approach. It's not an inside-out approach to producing stand-up comedy material, if that makes sense.
Well, I was going to say, if you're going to inside-out, outside me, I'm a little simple. So you go ahead and explain that a little bit.
Well, what I'm saying is you're trying to use these outside, quote-unquote, outside processes to develop stand-up comedy material that's going to supposedly get big laughs. I'm just not convinced that you can do that. Callbacks are a perfect example of how mechanically, if you don't know what you're doing, they can eat you alive. And I've seen this over and over and over again, where someone will set up a joke, they'll tell the joke, it doesn't work, then throughout their act, they'll call back to this stuff that wasn't funny to begin with. I mean, it's a very mechanical type of thing. The callback goes here.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, being that I've watched comedians perform, when we say callback, they set up a joke, they get a good laugh out of it, and then they keep bringing that in because it was funny.
Oh, dude.
You're saying that just the opposite. They're taking a joke that didn't get a laugh, and they keep bringing it back in. What, do they expect another laugh?
Well, exactly. And the problem is you get the opposite effect. The only time a callback's ever going to work is if you slaughtered on the joke that you're calling back to. If you didn't, it's wah, wah. I mean, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And the audience goes, that's not funny. And then the next time you do it, that's really not funny. And you don't get laughs from that. That's another aspect of this whole mechanical process to try to put together a stand-up comedy routine. Now, don't get me wrong. There is a structure. There is a way to structure what it is you want to say to make sure that you get the laughs, provided you know what a punchline is relative to you, not trying to pluck something from the air. And I would tell anyone that if you're trying to pluck funny out of thin air, you're doing this the hard way, the exceptionally hard way, because then it becomes a very much hit and miss kind of thing, just like the lotto. And you don't want the lotto. You want to have a pretty good idea that what you're going to say is going to generate laughs, and you need to have your material structured right from the beginning to get 4 to 6 laughs per minute. I mean, why shouldn't you do that? Think about this, Ron. I mean, these people are getting up just like I got up, and you're putting your sense of humor on the line for these audience, for this audience of people that don't know you.
Right.
Well, if you can't come across in a way that's going to get you that 4 to 6 laughs per minute, well, let's go back. Let's say that you don't even have 4 to 6 laughs per minute programmed into your material. How are you going to get it?
So the process is there, and yet it can be practiced and rehearsed and all that, those other things. But it has to be you. It has to be a process. It just can't be somebody else's idea how to get laughs.
Well, I'm just saying that there's an easy way and there's a really hard way. And this trying to extract funny out of thin air is about as hard as it gets.
Well, that kind of brings me right to my last question. I did want to ask, and this is something we have covered previously. Could you make clear for us the process for developing comedy material?
First of all, let me tell you that there's no right or wrong way when it comes to developing and delivering stand-up comedy material that works. And when I say works, it gets major laughs when you deliver it. If a comedian can get the laughs they need to make headway in stand-up comedy, then they've got a process that works. If they don't get the laughs they want from their stand-up comedy material, there's really only two reasons why. Either they don't really have the comedy talent that they need, which is usually not the case. There are some folks that just don't have comedy talent. They don't have the comedy talent God gave belly button length. That's just reality, but they think that they can, quote-unquote, learn how to do this. The more prevalent reason why people don't get the laughs that they want is because the process they're using to develop and deliver their stand-up comedy material, it's not working. It's not giving them the results that they want. So when I talk about the stand-up comedy process, I'm really referring to four major components. Determining what you want to talk about on stage, that's a really big deal. The next part, from my perspective, is adding the punchlines to the material. Adding the punchlines, the funny, to what it is you want to say and express to an audience. The next component is the preparation for delivering that material to an audience. And every single person listening to this right now needs to understand that every comedian that gets on stage and kills an audience, they usually provide the appearance of spontaneity.
When you say appearance of spontaneity.
Right. It appears as if the comedian is just simply, things are just popping into their head and they're just talking about it as they go along. That's a myth. That just doesn't happen. And you know, I'll tell you one of the most profound examples of this is many people thought that the late Robin Williams was a master at improv. Master, just a total master of improv. And yes, he did some improv during his act, his stand-up comedy act. But let me tell you, 95% of what he did on stage was absolutely rehearsed. He knew what he was going to do, when he was going to do it, how he was going to do it. That's the brilliance of Robin Williams. People didn't even know this. And the only reason I know about this is because I read interviews with him about how he would prepare for his act. You know, he had one part early on where he did like the death of a sperm. And it appeared to be very off the cuff, just random thought. No, no, no. Nay, nay, dragon breath. That's not the way it works. He just happened to master this appearance of spontaneity at a higher level than other people.
And as we know, the appearance that I got, and I guess most audience did get, is it was an appearance that he was doing this just from the right out of the air, plucked from the air. It really did look spontaneous.
Exactly. And here's the deal about the process that an individual uses when they're developing and delivering their stand-up comedy material. If an individual doesn't know how to determine what to talk about on stage, they can't really kind of figure out, well, what do I talk about, that kind of thing, then what that does is that affects the punchlines that they can add to that material. Well, it's not that funny to me, but here I need to somehow pluck funny out of the air with punchlines. So you've got that aspect. If you don't know what a punchline is relative to you and how you express yourself, well, doesn't matter what you talk about. If your punchlines don't work, then you're not going to get the laughs you want. It's a pretty simple thing. Another part of this is if you, let's say that you're maximally prepared. And this covers me when I first started. I was completely prepared, rehearsed as good as I could get, and those kinds of things. But if your material isn't funny, then it doesn't matter how well prepared you are, period.
Yeah, and you'd start, you know, our first show that you told about that it took you a while to realize the process we're going to continue in this series. But you were well prepared. You thought you had done everything you could possibly do, and then you still kind of, what was the word, sucked. Okay.
Yeah, well, kind of doesn't really cover it. I mean, I was just pretty much really sucked. The last part of the process is tightening your material so that if you're only getting two laughs per minute, let's say, then you need to increase that. You know that there's issues. And if you don't do performance review, then it, again, here we go. It's a hit and miss thing. Because keep this in mind, when a comedian stands on stage and they're delivering to an audience, they're not in self-evaluation mode. They shouldn't be. They should be in performance mode, 100% providing this appearance of spontaneity.
All right. So at that point, they should be recording some, you know, video or
every single audio. Every single show and know what to look for in order to tighten their material. I mean, this is a big deal that can literally shave years off a comedian's time it takes to really develop a high level, big laugh stand up comedy routine. And you're going to find that most comedians don't do this. I mean, it's really a hit and miss affair. It's just sad to me.
Well, you said something, and you know that we do that in education too. Is that we keep doing what works and quit doing what doesn't work, basically, is an easy way to say it. So if a comedian doesn't understand what he's doing right or wrong, he doesn't know what to take out or put in.
Well, you just hit it right. You hit the nose on the face. Okay. I guess is the way to put it. I mean, dude, I'm just telling you, if you don't know what you're doing at every phase of the process for developing and delivering stand-up comedy material, then you're subject to whatever results you get when you do finally get in front of that audience. And keep in mind, the only thing any comedian has in their pocket before they hit the stage is the process that they use to develop and deliver their material. I don't care if it's the most famous comedian in the world. I don't care if it's somebody who's been doing this all week. They still come armed to the stage with the process that they used to develop and ultimately deliver that material. And if they really don't know what they're doing, then it becomes this lotto factor thing. Well, that worked kind of. Well, how did that work? You know, how well did that work? Do I need to improve upon that? Well, this didn't work at all. What do I do with that? And then it's like, was it delivery? Because I kind of sucked on the delivery. Was it delivery? Was the material not good? Were the punchlines weak? Can you see what I'm trying to paint here?
Yeah, you're painting that. We're going right back to that same picture. Do what works. Quit doing what doesn't work. I think one of the other things you brought in, that spontaneity, the fact that they look like it's just coming out of, you know,
thin air.
It's just they're just so good at this. This comedy timing, I guess, is one of the words they use quite often.
This is the real magic of stand-up comedy, is this whole appearance that it's just them talking. And I can only venture to guess how many new comedians have gotten on stage and thought that they could just get up there and ramble on, you know, just talking off the top of their head and leave that stage going, man, I'm never going to do this again. Because I did this for 10 years. I talked about this.
Well, there's two comedians that just came to my mind when you said that, and that's Tim Allen and Ray Romano. Those two could get up and just tell a story, talk, and you're dying. You're just laughing yourself sick over this story that sounds like it just happened. They were in the supermarket. They were down the street. They were in their car. But always comes off really genuine, and it's funny.
Well, so just keep this in mind, too. By the time you see the video, by the time you see the recording or you see the DVD or you see the show on TV, do you have any idea how many times these people have performed the exact same material? venture to guess?
A bunch. I think there's a metric measurement we used to use in the Navy. It's called the butt load.
I will tell you, it's anywhere from dozens to hundreds of times.
So. And that's why I said it just looks, again, though, it looks like it's the first time they've ever done it, first time they ever told it. I mean, it really does give that appearance.
That's the thing, and they do this every single show. One of the things that I recommend new comedians do, if you want to check this out for yourself, spend the money, go to a professional stand-up comedy show, do it during the middle of the week, it costs less money, usually.
Okay.
Then go to the exact same show the very next night. The exact same show. Spend the money, go to the exact same show.
So you're going to see the same performance.
You're going to see almost the exact same performance. Now, you may see a few minutes of new material, but by and large, you will see almost the exact same performance.
Yeah, and that's kind of expected even from the club owners, right? Because they want them to bring people back to their club. The next comedian comes, got to be as funny as the last one. So they want to believe that.
Well, stand-up comedy is based on performing your stand-up comedy routine for new audiences. And the reason being is really quite simple. It's not like music, where people will come and listen to the same songs over and over and over again. That's why groups like Lynyrd Skynyrd don't ever seem to die.
Right.
If you get what I'm saying, they just come to listen to the same songs over and over and over again. Stand-up comedy doesn't work that way until you get to a certain level. Until you get to a certain part, those comedians are performing the same material over and over and over again. Well, once a joke is told, the surprise factor is gone.
Well, there's a comparison that just came to my mind was we go to a play or we go to a movie. it is the same exact. I mean, it is going to be the exact play every time you go. It's going to be the exact movie that you see it twice. But every once in a while, we do that. Friends want to go see the same thing we saw. We go with them. We can anticipate what's coming.
So, well, here's the thing.
You don't want to anticipate, I would say.
Well, here's the thing, too, is even if you've been to the same comedian show within a year, but you go with a different set of friends, you're still subject to that group dynamic laughter that we talked about. See? Oh. And so even if you know the joke, it's that contagiousness of laughter that gets you. Now, again, that's when a comedian gets to a certain level where they can draw people who have seen them before back. And keep in mind that every single performing comedian is always working on new material, especially those who have been on TV. Because once it goes on TV, it's kind of done. So they need to be able to produce more material.
Yeah, I guess that creates a much wider audience when you end up going on TV and it's viewed by 20 million people. It's kind of hard to do.
Well,
that.
There's...
But even the Comedy Channel, even saying that, the Comedy Channel, they'll put up a comedian. It's the same exact show they put on last week and the week after and so on. And we do watch it again. So sometimes it's just funny because it's funny.
Well, if you're talking about late night comedians who do their 6 or 7 minutes on The Tonight Show, is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about, you know, someone, an established comic. We'll use Chris Rock. He'll come on, do a show, and that same show is aired often on this Comedy Channel. It's the same show over and over. And it's still, there is still a part there that becomes funny. But we know it's a recording of the same show. But for him to continue, and that's all they ever show of him, he would basically wither and die.
Well, let's just put it this way. If the scenario that you're painting here where this comedian was plastered all over the TV and they showed it over and over and over again, and that's all they ever did, wah, wah. I mean, they would be toast.
Yeah, that's what I said. That would wither and die. But knowing that Chris Rock is out there putting on a new show that doesn't look anything like that brings in the audiences still. So he's having to develop a lot more material just because of the popularity of his stuff, the TV.
Well, I'll give you an example of someone who did a HBO special every 2 years, and that's George Carlin when he was alive. He did an HBO special every 2 years. And every 2 years, that was basically the end of his current act. And so for 2 years, he would work on the next act and then do the special. And then the special would air, and for the next 2 years, he'd work on the next act.
So he was letting the material die, or the material basically died?
Well, no, he just had to produce. If he wanted to do this over and over and over again, he had to produce a brand new act that people hadn't seen, that people hadn't seen every 2 years.
Well, he did it well.
Well, he did it for a long time. I mean, for a very long time. And so the amount of material that he developed was just amazing. I mean, you know of a comedian that I know you know this guy, David Brenner.
Right, yes.
Okay. David Brenner, funny man. And he was a very much a storytelling kind of comedian. Oh my goodness. He was just amazing. I had read somewhere that he had performed over 24 hours of original stand-up comedy material just on his Tonight Show appearances. Now, keep in mind, these are 6 and 7 minute performances.
Right.
I mean, if you put that into context, that's a lot of material, dude.
Now, well, prolific. I mean, that seems just like a lot of stuff. But he can pull on that, right? He can mix and match that for whatever audience he wants.
Sure, to a point. But just keep in mind that comedians are like everybody else. They grow. Their lives change. The things that they think funny changes. Just like with everybody else. So if you know what you're doing, it's not that difficult. Because funny happens around us all the time. It happens every day, every week. And if you know what you're doing and you know how to capture that and you know how to relay that to an audience and do it such that it just seems like it's coming off the top of your head, can you see how that can be an advantage?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I do that as a lecturer. When I'm giving a lecture, you know, they need to feel it's kind of fresh for them the first time, even though I just gave it the quarter before, the semester before, very similar, very, very similar stuff. The students got it for the first time in their mind. You know, it was brand new to them. And it wasn't so that I was looking for the spontaneity of it. It was the fact that they needed to feel it was fresh. First time anybody in the world has ever heard about this portion of the body during anatomy and physiology. Which was, you know, not true. They knew it came right out of the textbook. I just gave it in a way that was enjoyable. So I'm guessing that's what we're really talking about.
Yeah, but the key is those students had never seen you before. They had never seen your lecture before. They didn't know what you were going to do.
New audience. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's true. All right, well, let's jump into something else here. So there's another big part of comedy that I'd like you to help explain, and that's developing a special character for stand-up comedy. How do you do that?
Good question. I can't tell you how to do that. But here's what you got to understand from my perspective. Stand-up comedy is different than acting. And when somebody tries to develop a special character or a special persona or some unique entity outside who they already are, then they're moving towards the realm of acting. Because here's the deal. In stand-up comedy, let's just put it this way. In acting, great actors are great at becoming someone else. In stand-up comedy, great comedians are great at being themselves. And so let me just ask you a question. We had talked about this when you did your routine or lecture or what have you in the classroom. Did you get to any certain point of your lecture and suddenly turn into somebody that you weren't?
No. And the few times that other person snuck out, it was just disastrous. So, I've tried to be something I'm not, and it doesn't work.
Let me just put it to you this way. I'm not talking about doing your impression or imitation of someone else that you knew. You know, your aunt, your dad, your brother, a friend that you know, an acquaintance that you met. And everyone has done this where they mimic these people. They mock them, basically. They mock how they talk. They mock how they move. They've got the movements down, and it's close enough where people recognize what the deal is, and they crack up every time.
That's why I'm a hit on the dance floor.
Well,
I can imitate some of the worst dancers.
No. Here's the problem with your dancing deal is you've got pasty white man syndrome. Yeah. And I'm not sure that they have medicine for that now.
Yeah, it's called Jack Daniels, I think.
Is that what it is? Well, but what I'm saying is when I'm talking about a special character, I'm talking about someone that's outside yourself that's not who you are in everyday life. One of the best examples that I can think of right off the top of my head is a guy that I opened for. His name is Bobcat Goldthwait.
Oh, yeah, the screamer.
And yeah, he started out as this screechy, kind of nerdy, screechy guy. And it's funny that when I opened for him, he didn't do any of that. He had already transitioned into being himself. But one of the things that I want to point out that just really chaps me is if you take a look in stand-up comedy books, they will tell you that you need to develop this special character. You need to find this special stage voice. You need to become this special persona. But they don't provide you one lick of information on how to do this. Not one bit.
So if you were going, if you took that chapter of someone else's book, what would you tell them? Either to drop it completely, or if you're going to do this, understand you are acting now.
Well, think about this. Who you are right now, who anybody is right now who's listening to this, if they've got real comedy talent, they're already a well-developed character that people recognize and respond to. There's nothing they have to change. What happens is, and this is one of the big problems that I have with stand-up comedy books, is they imply or they express that you need to become this somebody else. As a matter of fact, they will go so far as to say, when you go on stage and suck, you can just blame it on this character. Well, you know, when I got up on stage and sucked, dude, that was me that felt that, not this stupid character.
Well, I think I brought this out in an earlier show, but I realized talking to you again and setting up, you know, some of the material we're doing for this show, is I realized one of my problem in public speaking was just that I lecture hours a day. I'm constantly in front of an audience. Let's call it an audience, but my students. Very comfortable. Not just because I know the material, because it is, that's my setting. That's my comfort zone. But the minute I stand, somebody asks me to speak in front of an audience that I don't know, a new audience, at a graduation or at a function or award ceremony, then I immediately start writing. I start writing out the speech. I start getting all my jokes together. I get everything. And I bomb every time.
Yeah, so that doesn't horrible. Really work out, oddly enough, huh?
And I think the big reason, that's why I said I discovered during this process, is that I try to become somebody else when I'm speaking publicly, when I'm doing something out of my comfort zone. And it doesn't work. At the few times that I really have been successful at one of those functions is when I made the huge mistake right at the beginning of my speech, and I realized I had to throw it all the way out, and then I just started doing a little dance. And then all of that, all of me came out, and then the things that I had rehearsed, the funny things that I had done in my life or stories I'd told, I could tell comfortably and gain the audience's at least attention, where before I was just, yeah, I was just painful for me and the audience because I was trying to be this great speaker.
Well, you know, when I started my stand-up comedy career, I tried to be what I thought a comedian should be on stage. Not me. I wasn't good enough. I needed to become something larger than life, which is a bunch of nonsense. And the real problem with this type of mentality is this. If you don't have acting skill, you're going to have a difficult time developing a new and different character. I've known comedians who did become, they went on stage and they expressed themselves in character. But I'm going to tell you now, every single one of them had a fairly extensive background in acting.
In other words, they were actors before they developed the character.
Absolutely. So, you know, this trying to develop some kind of unique character that's going to get laughs is like trying to grow another finger. I mean, you can study and study and study. Unless you know what you're doing, man, it's not going to work. And here's the irony
Let me throw something in there, because I hear something you're saying there that I think maybe will help me understand that piece, is that those that can act and they can create that persona or a special character and it works for them, you know, go for it. But really, if you're a new comedian, you're learning, you want to do stand-up, you know you have some comedy talent, then it's much easier to be yourself, be the funny self that you are, and work on that process. Unless you're already an established actor or actress, then you probably want to be yourself, not try to take on a special character.
Well, I hate to put this way, but, you know, you are already your own best character. You don't have to do anything. You just, you know, as far as how you present yourself, how you look, how you talk, those kinds of things, you don't have to do anything with that. That's one of the beautiful things about stand-up comedy is you can be yourself as opposed to other entertainment arts. For example, there are people, and I know you've been to karaoke nights. Have you been to karaoke nights anywhere?
Yeah.
And there's always anywhere from 3 to 5 what I would call ringers. People that get up there and you go, man, why doesn't this person have a recording contract?
Right. Really good.
But if you take a look at who they are, they weigh 300 pounds. They're thin. They may wear glasses. They're lanky. They might look like Popeye, you know, whatever the deal is. And in that industry, they are really focused on the look. You know, being able to sing is not enough. I mean, take a look at it. I mean, Meghan Trainor, Taylor Swift, any of these people, Justin Timberlake, blah, 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 blah. You know, they have a certain look, demeanor, handsomeness. Yeah, the Beeb. Yeah, Justin Butthead.
Hey, we're trying to keep audience here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, if you like that guy, good on you.
Is it?
But you see what I'm saying? But as a comedian, it's completely different. You can be whoever you are. I mean, look at Roseanne Barr. Now, dude, she wasn't winning no beauty pageants when she started. I promise you that.
Yeah, you have a point there. And that was really, you know, her act became her. She's one of those that admittedly took forever to become, to make a living at this, but kept it up until she was. But she really did become that individual that ended up on the TV show. I mean, that really became her persona. Now, I don't know if that was acting from the beginning, but she was funny. Oh my God, she was funny.
Oh my, yeah, she was very funny.
And well, you had said something early on about yourself, that there were things that you didn't particularly care for yourself and was trying to change.
Well, the thing about it is I had fallen into this from the stand-up comedy books that I'd gotten, you know, this character thing, and I wasn't getting results. Now, I was working my butt off. It didn't occur to me that the process that I was using wasn't going to serve me. So, you know, I would blame my poor performances on, for example, my accent. I have a fairly distinct Southern accent. I was born and raised in Texas. I like the accent. I actually thought about getting rid of that stupid accent. I thought, man, if I could just get rid of the stupid accent, I could get better laughs on stage. Well, this is the same kind of crap that other people put up with, too. They think, oh, you know, if I was taller, if I was thinner, if I wore better clothes, if I did this and I did that, then my act would be funnier. Well, if I had a better stage name, blah, 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 blah. And it's not about that. It's not about that at all. So when it comes to, you know, I would tell anybody, if you feel that stand-up comedy is for you and you feel that that's going to be a lead-in to acting, don't ignore the acting part. I mean, there's a lot of comedians who end up on movies and TV shows and that kind of stuff. And it sure wouldn't hurt to be able to know about acting, blocking, sets, and those kinds of things. All the things that you need to know about acting, which is different than stand-up comedy. It would be to a person's advantage. The other thing is if you get involved in a reputable reputable acting class, many times, those instructors, if they're actually connected and they're good instructors, they will be tapped for students for potential auditions for TV shows, commercials, and those kinds of things. And let me just tell you, I've known stand-up comedians who have basically made their living doing TV commercials. And you wouldn't be able to pick them out on the street. You really wouldn't. They do, you know, commercial here, commercial there. People really don't know how much money TV commercial, national TV commercial pays. It's substantial.
Well, you know, you bring up a point there, too, is that often somebody becomes famous, you know, somebody that wasn't famous, and then all of a sudden we're looking back and seeing that they had done commercials, you know, and that was a way to basically keep food on the table until they actually broke into the business or made it big. Let's say.
Well, I think stand-up comedians who also pursue acting really are double dipping, because they can hit the acting thing when it happens, but they also have the stand-up comedy that they can fall back on, that they can make a little jack from too. So you get where I'm coming from. Whereas when you're acting, just acting and trying to live off acting. Ooh, baby. That can be a hard row to hoe. But if you can make an audience blow milk out their nose, even if they haven't had any in a while.
Gross.
Dude, I'm just telling you, you can go far as a comedian. There ain't no doubt about it. So, and just to give you some idea, and this has been a while, but I knew a comedian who got tapped for three national beer commercials. He was in three beer commercials starring Bob Uecker and him. And he only had like one line or two lines maximum. He did three of these. You know how much those were worth?
No.
Almost $100K.
Just three. So $33,000 a piece, basically.
Approximately.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not a bad living. But
well, you know, when you can get those. Now, I haven't seen him in anything since, so, but I don't. I don't know. I don't watch a whole lot of TV, and, you know, he may have been on something else. But for people who make a mark in stand-up comedy and want to move to New York or L.A., if they can get into acting and get involved in the TV commercial thing. If they've got the look, the something that'll get them going, that's one way to keep yourself alive while you're waiting for something bigger and not having to starve to death.
That is and speaking of starving to death, is we spent a lot of time when you first started, or at least when I thought you first started, because I always thought you were pretty funny, and to find out that you actually spent a period of time sucking, I missed out on. But we went to a lot of open mic nights. You know, can you talk a little bit about open mic nights?
Well, let me just ask you. You said you've been to comedy open mic nights.
I have.
And tell me what you saw. I mean, and be specific about it.
Not very tactful specific. Okay, they suck. It was the, you know, maybe a first couple of comedians were funny, and then it was just, it was embarrassing. It was so hard to watch some of these people trying their best to do something that they want to do, but, oh, they suck. It's mostly suck.
And you know what's bad about the whole comedy open mic night thing is that it's not like karaoke. If somebody sucks at karaoke, it's funny. I mean, it's hilarious. But if somebody sucks at stand-up comedy, man, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard. And it's pretty bad. And I would recommend that every single person who's thinking about jumping into stand-up comedy go and sit through not one, but multiple comedy open mic nights, because you'll be able to see some amazing things. And then if you go to a real paid comedy show, you'll be able to contrast the difference. But I'm here to tell you, at most stand-up comedy open mic nights, the people are extremely unprepared. They don't know what they're talking about. They're having to use notes. They haven't spent any time rehearsing. You can tell very easily. You can see if they're riddled with stage fright, which is something that I want to talk about at length in a future episode. Or they will try to force funny on an audience. And man, you can't force people to laugh. They'll try to wing it, which is also known in the business as riffing. And then here's another little secret that folks don't know. Riffing, a lot of that is something that the comedian has already done dozens, if not hundreds of times, and knows what the questions are and the answers are.
So sometimes it is prepared riffing.
Yeah, riffing. It's known as a freestyle kind of thing where people are just, they're truly improvising, when the fact is that most riffing isn't. Again, it's not improvising.
Okay, let me ask you, riffing, that's really good, because I use something in my lectures that I actually ask questions that I have to have a very specific answer for in order to continue the entertainment style of my teaching. So I've told students, when I ask this question, raise your hand, I'll pick on you, and they answer it, so I've set it up. Or I've actually just looked over at a student and said, exactly right, that's exactly right, and give the answer. So it was a way for me to riff. I think we've just found a term for it. Looked like I was completely winging it, and yet what I was is it was set up.
Yeah, but here's the deal. You knew the questions you were going to ask, right?
Correct.
And you knew the potential answers that you could get.
That's the other side.
Okay, you knew the answers that you could get, and you knew all the responses that you could give to the various answers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my goodness. Well, that doesn't sound very improv-y to me.
You know, and that's the other side about, you know, after you do this often enough, and I think that's where the audience can, my audience, and I know that I've seen it often in comedy clubs and comedy routines, is they do elicit certain responses from the audience, and sometimes they actually get exactly what they want. But you can tell they're prepared for almost anything that comes out of it. You know, they just look like they're so smart and so sharp and so quick, but it really is, that's really a polished act, is what you're saying. They know exactly what's, just like I do, I know exactly what I'm going to say, no matter what the answer is sometimes. Kind of like politicians, you know, you ask a politician a question.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And that politician but answers it with something you don't, it doesn't even sound the same. Okay.
But again, this is part of that magic of stand-up comedy that we were talking about before. Even when someone riffs, I'll tell you who's awesome at this. And if you take a look at the end of any DVD or comedy performance on TV of D.L. Hughley, many times his last 15 minutes, 20 minutes, can be audience interaction. And dude, you know, it looks like he's just off the cuff, talking with these people, blah, 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 blah. And I can tell you, I promise you, there's nothing off the cuff about what he's doing there. But this is, again, this is something that throws a lot of new comedians off. They think that this off the cuff, they do their off the cuff thing. Wah, wah, they suck. Okay. Another thing is they try to be this unnatural character. Okay. They may have the funniest material in the world, but they try to be this phony, unnatural character that's trying to get laughs. And guess what? It doesn't happen. And then another big thing that the open mic comedians don't do is they don't record their performance for any kind of improvement. It's just like you take it up on stage, it worked or it didn't work, and then you just kind of try to change it willy-nilly when you get off. Dude, I can't think of a worse way to approach stand-up comedy than to not really know what you're doing. It's like I said before, when you get on stage, you're not in performance improvement mode. And if you try to remember that stuff that happened, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. There are times when you can get on stage and not think you're doing very well, and you were actually killing. It could be the room. If the room has really high ceilings, laughter evaporates, and you can think, man, I'm not doing that good, and you're actually killing them. But you wouldn't know that unless you had some type of recording, a video recording, an audio recording, some kind of recording. But the biggest thing is, and just so that people know, because I know there's folks listening to this saying, well, you know, what about in London? What about in Hong Kong? What about in Germany? It doesn't matter. Comedy open mics are the same. People get up, they think they got it dialed in, and then they suck. They don't understand what the deal is, or they're just trying to throw out these stupid jokes that aren't going to ever work because they were kind of dreamed up out of nowhere. They have no foundation. There's no energy here. If I just spit this stuff out, then it's going to get massive laughter. And it doesn't work that way. Not at all.
Okay, so understanding the process really is the trick. Really the trick to get this done in a fair amount of time.
Well, and in all fairness, when people buy stand-up comedy books and they go to classes and those kinds of things, they think that what they're getting is a process that's going to work for them.
Yeah, why buy the book if you don't think it'll work?
Exactly. And so when they get that and they try to put this stuff into action, they can't seem to figure out why what they're doing is not working. And it's really, really frustrating because if you're doing everything the books say and it's not working, then you really don't have any sort of foundation for improvement at all. There's nothing there. It's just an empty shell. And so you end up doing what I call blind trial and error. You throw something up, you see if it works. You throw something up, you see if it works. You throw something up, you see if it works. And you just do that until you gather up enough things that work. The problem with that, the other problem, is that when you do have stuff that does work, you don't know why it worked. Because of it's this process. It's this stupid hit and miss lottery process. It's just horrible. So I'm not a bit. We'll talk more about comedy open mic nights, but I'm just telling you, it's just whoo. And new comedians do not take advantage of comedy open mic nights. Like I said, they get on stage, they're not prepared, they haven't rehearsed, they don't really know what they're doing. They use notes. I mean, the second you take a look at notes, dude, you know what that means? Audiences aren't stupid. Wah wah. They know.
Yeah, you've become the amateur that they already believe you are.
That is a great way to put that.
Yeah, there's something about, you know, like I said, I was embarrassed. I mean, I'd watch these guys and I would just become embarrassed for them sometimes because it just, you knew that they were putting all of themselves into it at that moment, but they still suck. So.
Well, I'll just tell you. The stand-up comedy books will tell you it takes 5 to 6 years to get good as a comedian. And if you understand what I've been talking about, it's pretty easy to understand why. I don't think that it needs to take 5 to 7 years to get good on stage. Now, it may take you 5 to 7 years to accumulate enough material to become a headliner and to establish yourself as a headliner. But as far as being funny on stage, you should be able to whack audiences in months. Not years, dude. Months.
let me use your experience. Really, I mean, with the from start to finish, when did you headline the first show? How many years have you been in this?
Okay.
Remember, you went through. You had to learn the process that you're basically selling now. Is a nice way to say it.
Well, I had to develop it, and the deal is, well, here in November of 1992, I threw out all my paper written jokes, my pluck from the air jokes, like what most people are doing, and started using my system. I won the April 1993. I won the comedy competition, and I was actually headlining one nighter. Types of things within a year of that. So, but I other things happen and, you know, I, the way I put it is I was, headlining, 600 to 1500 seat venues within 30 months. But the reality is I was headlining small venues much earlier than that.
Well, and I saw, that's what I said. I saw it looked like a pretty fast movement, but you said something really important. When you threw out all of the stuff you thought you were supposed to do as a comic, all of the books that you had read and the processes that you were trying and the lotto version of stand-up comedy, when you threw that all out, 5 months from that point, you won a comedy stand-up comedy talent show.
Yeah.
That's got to say a lot about the process that you developed.
Well, I mean, it's worked well for me. It's worked well for thousands of other people. And not everyone gets famous. You know, it's not about that. It's about, are you able to entertain those butts in the seats? That's really what it's about.
And if this is something you really love to do, can you make a living doing it? And I think that's something you're bringing up, right? You can probably make a living.
Well, you know what? I'm going to talk about that aspect of it, as we move along. But at the worst case scenario, stand-up comedy is the best part-time career you could ever have. Let me just say that.
All right. Well, with that said, we've run out of time, but there's much more to come. So don't miss the next episode when we reveal more stand-up comedy secrets for beginners.